You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. It's a public health crisis federal officials say is a profound threat to the well-being of Americans and has gone underappreciated for too long. But it's not a virus or a disease. It is the increasing level of loneliness and isolation felt by millions of Americans, both young and old. U.S. Surgeon General Dr. Vivek Murthy made headlines this month by declaring loneliness and isolation an epidemic that has harmed both individual and societal health. The physical health consequences he outlined in this announcement states that the health risks of loneliness are as deadly as smoking up to 15 cigarettes a day and can significantly increase the risk of heart disease, stroke, dementia, and even early death. It is a crisis decades in the making, but it was brought to the forefront by the pandemic when the virus forced much of society to shut down and find alternative ways to stay connected with friends, loved ones, or lose touch entirely. To help us better understand this health crisis and how we can live happier, more connected lives, we've invited Dr. Sonia Lubomirsky to join us. She is a distinguished professor of psychology at UC Riverside and the author of two books on the science of human happiness. Thanks for joining us. Good morning.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
So you are a recognized expert in the science of happiness. What intrigued you to pursue a career studying what makes us happy?
It was actually kind of serendipitous. In graduate school, I sat down with my advisor and we started talking about, like, what is the secret to happiness and why are some people happier than others? And that was over 30 years ago. And back then, you know, very few people were studying and thinking about happiness. It was considered kind of a fuzzy, unscientific topic. But now there is really a whole science of happiness. You know, neurosciences are studying it. Economists are studying it. So it's a big topic now.
Yeah. Three decades later. I mean, you have stated in interviews that the key to happiness is social connection. Why do you believe that's the cornerstone to human happiness?
You know, I spent about 20 years doing what we call interventions to try to make people happier. So they're kind of like clinical trials. But instead of testing a new treatment, a vaccine, we're testing like a happiness strategy, like gratitude or be kind to others. And I realized a few years ago that almost everything that works to make people happy works because it makes them feel more connected. So if I ask people to write gratitude letters, they're almost always write them, you know, to like their mom or their best friend, and it makes them feel more connected with that person. If I ask people to do acts of kindness, it's almost always something, you know, one-on-one, or so you're feeling connected. It's yes, some people do, you know, anonymous giving, but that's actually pretty rare, at least in our research. So connection, I mean, it's not surprising, right? Human beings are wired for, we're social animals, for wired for connection. So almost every strategy that people use to become happier has to do with increasing social connection. So now I've become interested in sort of how do we foster connection.
And those seem like simple actions, you know, that helps our health. But the reason why we invited you to talk to us today is because of the U.S. The Surgeon General's up report or advisory describing an alarming and devastating rise in loneliness and isolation in our country. Are these symptoms behind loneliness as simple as just feeling lonely, or is it deeper than that?
Mm-hmm. You know, it's such a complicated question. There's two kinds of loneliness. There's chronic loneliness, which really is, you can almost think of it as a trait. You know, it's quite, I don't want to say intractable, but it's really hard. It's really challenging to change. And then there's situational loneliness, which for a lot of people that happened during COVID, or when you start college and you move to a different city, right, you might be lonely for, or your kids leave for college, you might be lonely for a few months or a year. But, you know, I think there's lots of little things that we could do, kind of like lots of little things that add up, right, that aggregate, that we can to sort of battle loneliness or any kind of problem. But it is a very, very difficult problem. You can't just sort of throw friends at lonely people. And I just wanted to also mention that it's really a subjective state, right? It's not about, you can be surrounded, it's kind of a cliche, but you can be surrounded by lots of people and still feel lonely. You can have people that, again, a classic example, like the billionaire, where like everyone wants to be friends with you, but you are, you know, suspicious of their motives. So you actually feel lonely, even though lots of people want to be friends with you. So it's not about that. So it's really a very challenging problem.
I think some people might be surprised that, you know, when we talk about the health consequences of loneliness, that it can increase the risk of heart disease, stroke, dementia, and even early death. How does it lead to these health impacts?
You know, I'm not an expert on sort of those kind of biological pathways, but there's sort of research on the neuroscience of loneliness, kind of lack of sort. Again, we're sort of wired for connection. When there's a lack of connection, you know, that actually harms our brains. There's things that happen in our body. Cortisol levels might be elevated. So again, I'm sort of not, this is not my area of expertise, but there's sort of a number of biological pathways that can occur to create those health effects.
But given that there has been those connections, do you mm-hmm. think that loneliness is as urgent of a public health crisis and should be prioritized like other ones, such as obesity, heart disease, or even opioid use?
You know, absolutely, absolutely. And it's so interesting how anything to do with sort of mental health, anything to do with something that's sort of subjective and perceived is often considered sort of not as important as something you can actually see in the body. Like you see the cancer growing in your body and that seems like, or something's wrong with your heart and that just seems like a bigger problem. Whereas, you know, the sort of the connection between mind and body is just so strong. And you can see the data, you can see from the report, the data that shows that loneliness has these, you know, really huge harms, health-wise. So it's a public health crisis for sure. It's not just a psychological crisis. It's not just like, oh, we feel bad for people who are lonely. It affects all of us, right? And affects family members and communities and classrooms, workplaces, and of course, hospitals.
Right. I mean, given that you're an expert in this, this is your wheelhouse. When you read the advisory and the report, did anything surprise you or stand out to you?
Sure. Well, I thought it was an incredible report and so timely. But there was really a huge focus in that report on kind of structural issues, kind of like how can we change people's environments to help people feel more integrated in them, to feel less lonely. And so something I think that we want to have, you know, just in my opinion, although I'm a psychologist, so I'm biased, is that we want to sort of talk a little bit more about how can we help people as individuals to feel less lonely? So not to put the onus on them, not to blame them, not to put the onus on them, but I think there's room for all kinds of different interventions, both at sort of the structural, you know, environmental, organizational levels or community levels. You know, we can create neighborhoods that foster less, more connection. But we also can help individuals. So something that I think often, for example, is not talked about is a lot of lonely people are shy and lack social skills. So how can we teach those social skills? It's really hard to do. You can't just be like, hey, let me, you know, send you to a workshop, you know, so I'm not the expert on that, but I think there are people out there who know how to do this. Lonely people often are kind of cynical and suspicious of other people's motives. So you can't just kind of throw friends at them because they're going to feel they're going to be sort of defensive, cautious about other people, suspicious of like, why is this person talking to me? I think one of the best interventions for loneliness is to actually ask lonely people to help others. So like it's sort of because we really are, we want symmetry. We don't want just people to help us. I mean, yes, like a therapist or a coach might help, but that's very one-sided. And so a lonely person really wants to have that sense of like autonomy and competence and efficacy where they're also reaching out and helping others. And so mm-hmm. one example on college campuses where there's a huge loneliness epidemic, right? Especially like, freshmen and sophomores where everyone kind of, because of social media, there's a study that showed that college students, most of them think that everyone else has made friends except for them, right? Because they see people posting like photos of themselves. And so asking college students, like maybe giving them younger buddies or maybe, befriending and helping international students who might sort of need more support. And so that's one way to sort of help lonely people is sort of to help them, to actually ask them to help others, which is a little bit counterintuitive. So I think that individual level is also critical in addition to sort of the structural level.
Yeah, what I'm hearing from you, especially with that anecdote with college students, you know, perception plays a huge role in this, right? Like we have to get outside of our own heads. But this has existed for years or decades. Why do you think in recent years, even before the pandemic, because the report highlighted that people were disengaging from houses of worship or civic organizations and even family members over the last two decades, pre-2020, why do you think such a high number of Americans felt increasingly lonely or even isolated?
It's such an interesting question. I mean, I don't know if the same kind of loneliness questions have been asked over many years, because when you look at like decades ago, there's that book, Robert Putnam's Bowling Alone, right? Which argued that that we are, you know, we're not in bowling leagues anymore, right? And so we're sort of less lonely. So it's interesting because, like, even decades ago, the same kind of problem was posed. So I'm not sure how to compare sort of across history, but, you know, it is interesting. I mean, it's possible that, you know, social media, smartphone use contributed to this. I mean, although there's also some evidence showing that it actually makes people less lonely because, right, you're able to reach out in ways that we weren't able to reach out.
It was
before.
A tool during the pandemic because we couldn't be with each other.
Yeah, exactly. Like I've always had au pairs who travel from, you know, different countries to help our families. And I know they're always, I mean, we started this 24 years ago. So we've had 24 years of au pairs. And at the beginning, they were really lonely. And then with social media and with sort of WhatsApp, you know, they actually started to be less lonely when they travel. So it's really a puzzle to me why there's more loneliness now. I mean, but yes, maybe people being, not spending as much time sort of in like community groups. Certainly you see teenagers spending more time, and there's evidence for this, they're sort of spending more time kind of in their bedrooms, like all weekend. I think it used to be that you were kind of stigmatized, you know, like my generation, if you were not socializing, you know, outside of school. And now that's actually extremely common. So I should mention, I think there's definitely a role for social media and sort of, you know, digital ways of connecting, maybe even chatbots. There might be a role for AI to help us be less lonely as just one little way, like a supplement. But again, human beings are really hardwired for face-to-face connection, right? We are hardwired for sort of that eye contact, touch, you know, smell, like just sharing the same air, right? Which is why Zoom always feels a little unnatural. We're not literally sharing the same air, although I would still say that it's better to have Zoom, you know, happy hours rather than nothing.
Yeah, it's a tool in the toolbox. It's not the solution, and it doesn't replace, you know, actual human connection in person. You know, but this advisory also noted that young Americans, you know, 15 to 24 years old, are experiencing higher rates of loneliness compared to other age groups, and they're spending less time with their friends. We talk about social media; it's a double-edged sword, right? You know, and often when we talk about social media and youth or young adults, it's connected to mental and behavioral health struggles. Do you think that is the main culprit in this, for this specific demographic?
I don't know if it's a main culprit. I think it's a big culprit. So actually, if you look at happiness surveys, so basically age 14 to 24, 14, 28 are the least happy individuals. So it makes sense. They're also the most lonely, less connected individuals. It is a really, you sort of, people think, oh, I'd like to be young. No, you probably don't want to be young again because that is a time, that's a really difficult time and people in young people's lives. That what the research shows is that when you look at smartphone use, screens, you know, digital sort of interactions, digital media, as we call it, these are all correlations. So it's really hard to sort of kind of identify what the causal direction is, although there's some experiments as well. But it turns out it's really girls and young girls, really tween and teen girls, where there's evidence of harms. You know, boys tend to use digital means to play games, to play video games. Often those are social games, right? They involve other people, even if they're in other countries. And so they don't seem to be sort of as harmed as girls are. So I think if we need to focus sort of on a target to help somehow, to help them feel more socially isolated, girls also suffer more from kind of FOMO, feeling like they're being left out. They see photos of people, you know, having fun. And then there's a lot of sort of appearance-based, you know, self-esteem issues, sort of body issues that when everyone is sort of sending their most beautiful self out there. So that is something we have to really worry about is tween and teen girls. Mm.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. We're talking with Dr. Sonia Lubomirsky, professor of psychology at UC Riverside, about loneliness and isolation being declared an epidemic. Is there a place in the country or in the world that is a gold standard for connectedness?
There's a couple of books about what are called blue zones that author Dan Buettner has written about. And these are places in the world where people live very long. They live sort of past 100. And what he finds is that the key seems to be social capital, kind of social integration. And so I don't know about actual loneliness data in these places, but people clearly sort of are more socially connected. And so there's a, for example, an area of Siberia where this is true, like very long living people. There's a area in Italy, sort of in the Mediterranean, I think Sardinia, an area of Japan, and also an area of California where you have these sort of very long living people that are also very socially integrated. I should say religious communities often are very socially integrated. I mean, you could find that social connection without religion, but certainly they create structures that help people sort of not feel lonely. So I guess I would point to those blue zones or people are zones where people are most socially connected.
I hate to put you on the spot, but do you know the area in California off the top of your head?
I believe it's Loma Linda.
Oh,
it's Loma
okay.
Linda, California. Yes, yeah, Southern California, near where I live.
Good to know. You highlight a really important point, right? Because it helps a community potentially live longer. So by having these social connections, it goes well beyond just one individual's mental or physical health. It pays dividends across the community.
Absolutely. And again, not just for the individual, but for their family, right? For their workplace, for their neighborhood. Because when we're talking about all these physical health harms, it makes sense that they would add up to sort of lower, less long life. Now, again, I want to stress that this is correlational evidence, right? So we can't really be like, we're not definitively, sure that this is happening. But I think a lot of this evidence is adding up to suggest strongly that loneliness, that sort of reducing loneliness might actually increase longevity.
Part of this report actually had some solutions. There was a national strategy to strengthen social connection on a national level for essentially building more social infrastructure like parks, libraries, playgrounds, reforming digital environments, enacting and promoting a culture of connection, which is pretty nuanced. I mean, the last one sounds a little abstract, but do you think that this can actually be done on a local, state, national, and even tribal level to help people strengthen their connectedness to one another?
Absolutely. I think it's a really important, again, sort of an important tool and actually a very powerful tool in the toolbox to alleviate loneliness. Obviously, there has to be buy-in from, various constituents to make this happen. Money is involved that you need to make this happen and sort of motivate people to be motivated. I do kind of feel like everyone gets it. Like we've all been lonely, at least at certain times.
I think a lot of us has felt it. We've experienced
exactly.
it.
So we can identify with which is a plus, right? We can all kind of identify it. We all know people. I certainly have friends and family members that have gone through periods where they've been quite lonely, have sort of confessed to that. And so, it's something that hits all of us. And so hopefully the more this is sort of out in the air, and also a lot of people, I think, are ashamed about feeling loneliness. And it's not something that you want to kind of admit, especially when you're young. Everyone wants to sort of, you want to be perceived as sort of, popular and relatively happy. Admitting that you don't have a best friend, I think it's very hard. Yeah. And there's been times in my life that I haven't had a best friend. And, you kind of feel bad about that. Like, is there something wrong with me? Everyone else has a best friend, not me. So yes, I think that's a really, really important part of that toolbox is to create sort of better infrastructures.
Yeah, it takes a certain level of vulnerability, which is difficult and one that arguably society doesn't necessarily teach us. In the last minute that we have, given that you've authored two books on the science of happiness, one of which is titled The Myths of Happiness, what are some of the biggest societal myths regarding happiness that could help reduce someone's feeling of loneliness?
Well, interesting. Not sure how if they're necessarily related to loneliness. But some of the most important myths are sort of like that happiness is sort of out there to find. And often it lies in like something like I'll be happy when I move to that other city. And you could, I guess, change that to like I'm lonely now, but I'll be less lonely if only I had a boyfriend, if only I moved to that city, if only I had a different job. And so really happy. It sounds like a cliche, but really happiness lies from within. And I like to think about it. There's a theory in psychology called self-determination theory. And out of that theory has come this sort of idea that there are really sort of three buckets of things we need to work on if we want to be happy. And the first one is social connection. Okay, you won't be surprised to find anything we can do to nurture and to sort of improve, increase our social connections, whether it's with one person, whether it's with God or even our pets, maybe even that chatbot or the robot that we might have as a helper, is going to make us a little happier. The second thing is contributing to community, helping others. Again, that is also very connecting. Helping others, whether it's taking your nephew to the zoo or contributing to charity. And the third one is personal growth. Anything we can do where we can learn and expose ourselves to new challenges, new opportunities, also can contribute to happiness. So I kind of like to think of those sort of three buckets that we need to all work on to be happier people.
Yeah, and it doesn't only have to be humans. I think pets can help too.
Absolutely.
Sonia, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you.
Dr. Sonia Lyubomirsky is a distinguished professor of psychology at UC Riverside, discussing the loneliness epidemic and how we can live happier, more socially connected lives. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.